It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We open the lines to your questions about diabetes management. According to the State Health Department, over 500,000 adults in our state live with the disease. Thanks to Louise and Amaro, who called in recently to suggest we talk about type 1 diabetes. And then Nan in Milwaukee, who wants to learn about type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance, along with coping and nutrition after a diagnosis. Call in with your question or comment at any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Gossett is a certified nurse practitioner in endocrinology, specializing in diabetes and metabolism at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. And Dr. Disha Narang is here, endocrinologist and director of obesity medicine at Northwestern Medical Group in Lake Forest, Illinois. Dr. Narang, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, well, let's start with you, Dr. Narang. The Diabetes Research Institute saying more than 37 million Americans have diabetes and diagnosed cases are growing at a very concerning rate. Why are cases rising?
Yeah, there's so many reasons. I think obviously we start with genetics, and that is just exacerbated by our current environment. And so, you know, obesity is very much tied to type 2 diabetes. So if we're looking at, you know, the next 7 years, the projected, rise in obesity is we're looking at 50% of our American population suffering from obesity by year 2030. So we're not obviously very far from that. Increases in obesity is leading to significant increases in type 2 diabetes. And that, of course, is leading to a whole host of other complications from diabetes as well. And so they're very much tied together. And you know, the treatment certainly goes hand in hand. But our environment is very much exacerbating it. Our food environment is very much exacerbating it. And so, you know, we certainly got a very significant public health issue on our hands.
Sarah, before we go further, just make sure that we understand the difference here between type 1 and type 2 diabetes.
Sure. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disorder. You cannot cause it. It's usually diagnosed in childhood, but not always. Type 2 is associated with insulin resistance. So your pancreas is still working. It's either not producing enough insulin or the insulin you're producing is not being used effectively in the body. As Dr. Narang said, it's associated with obesity and sometimes inactivity.
Can the body gradually over years then become more insulin resistant due to those health effects like obesity?
Yes. Yeah, so diabetes is a progressive disease. So over time, more of the beta cells of the pancreas that produce insulin do tend to become non-functional. So people tend to need additional medications over time to keep diabetes under control in addition to the cornerstone of diet and exercise.
Dr. Narang, looking at the costs associated with this disease, the American Diabetes Association says people with diabetes incur nearly $17,000 a year in medical expenses, and those costs are 2.3 times higher than they would be without diabetes. What is Yes. often requiring medical attention and contributing to those costs?
Well, so first of all, medication, increased medical visits. If diabetes goes unchecked, you know, for some time, patients may develop the complications of diabetes, and that could include diabetic eye disease, nerve disease, kidney disease, heart disease. So there's a lot of consequences of untreated diabetes over time, you know, foot infections, amputations, all of these things add up to cost a lot of money over the lifetime of a patient, right? And so, you know, this is exactly why we emphasize preventive care, that we start early. We don't want to let this go, even though initially it might be, you know, silent and people might not necessarily feel bad, you know, having borderline high blood sugars or that sort of thing. But over time, this certainly becomes a complicated disease. And it leads to other diseases as well. So not only, so again, complications of diabetes, we've got all the medical visits, we've got all the medications. And so this stuff adds up. And if you multiply that by the millions and millions of people in this country that are developing this disease, and the projected rise in diabetes prevalence, well, we've got a large problem on our hands, and a very costly issue here.
Discussing diabetes care with Dr. Nisha Narang at Northwestern Medical Group. And Sarah Gossett is here, certified nurse practitioner at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, fielding your questions at 800-642-1234. Liz is joining us from Lyons. Liz, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I do not have any insurance. I'm not covered for Badger Care, or I cannot afford the healthcare.org insurance. So I've been forced to buy the Walmart equivalent of Novalin. I have been taking Tresiba for a very long time, and it's working very well. I have taken Novalin in 05, but unfortunately they took me off as I had a seizure with a low blood sugar in the night. This medication is my only option, and I don't. And also, I would like to know if there is anyone I can talk to restarting this Novalin, if there are any free clinics for diabetics anywhere that I can go to.
Liz, thank you so much for your questions. Appreciate it. Dr. Narang, you first.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear about your struggles with getting coverage for insulin. It's such an issue right now to find affordable insulin. The one thing I would recommend is that, a lot of these companies, for example, the company that produces Tresiba, they may actually have assistance programs that you can sign up with and be able to get the insulin at a much discounted rate. And so I would check their website and see if you could qualify for some of these assistance programs. And so a lot of the companies that are producing insulin do have some of these benefits that people in your situation may really be able to take advantage of. And in terms of the local clinics, I'm going to let our colleague here answer your question about that, because I'm in Illinois.
Yes, Sarah, go ahead. And also, looking at the caps that that the Inflation Reduction Act put for insulin manufacturers, what could you say there as well?
Yeah, so there is an insulin cap of $35 a month. I think there are a couple of loopholes there still. I've had some patients report to me that it's not as straightforward. That may apply to commercial insurance, but as Dr. Narang said, contacting the manufacturer directly, there are patient assistance programs where you can get a certain amount per month of both types of insulins that you need. It also is talking with the pharmacist, too, about your situation. They often know how to run things, so you can get it at a lower price. There may be rebates available. As for clinics, there are free clinics around. You just have to find them. I know in La Crosse we have St. Clair Health Mission, and they do have all of the insulins available that you would need or any other medications. And they have a diabetes clinic where they have endocrinologists from both healthcare systems come for appointments.
And it's not just the insulin. What about the insulin pumps and the glucose monitoring devices that don't involve finger sticks? What are costs associated there, and are they covered?
They are for people without insurance or people with insurance?
I mean, kind of both, because there have been so many advancements with devices and technology.
I think these devices are a fantastic tool for anyone with diabetes, and it's also great for clinicians, too, because we can see what's happening over 24 hours rather than just certain points in time. You can pay cash for one. The Freestyle Libre is about $75 a month, which I know is still very cost prohibitive for many people, but that would be the cheapest one available with manufacturer rebates. Many insurances do cover them, but they may have certain criteria that need to be met. So if you're on oral medications for type 2 diabetes only, it may not be covered. Some cover them outright, no questions asked, and some you have to be on up to 3 injections of insulin a day to get it covered.
Liz, thank you so much for calling in. Dr. Narang, are there any newer medications proving to be more effective for treating diabetes?
Yeah, so for type 1 diabetes, you know, the indication is insulin only. There are some off-label uses of a couple oral medications and some of the injectable medications. For type 2 diabetes, you know, it's an exciting time, you know, to be treating diabetes because we have, you know, several therapeutics available to us. And so the most recent and of course, you know, the most popular and more so because of all the weight loss advantages, but has been the GLP-1 agonist category. We've been using these for diabetes management for well over a decade at this point, but they've been very, very effective in lowering blood sugars. But we also can't forget all the other therapeutics that we have available. We have lots of other oral medications that, in combination with, you know, the GLP-1 agonist and or insulin can really be effective in lowering overall blood sugar averages. And so, you know, I think it's important to have an individual discussion with your doctor to understand what medications would be a good fit. You know, there's certain things we have to make sure that we look at someone's kidney function. We need to make sure that we look at the rest of their medical history, like, you know, do they have congestive heart failure? You know, do they have a history of pancreatitis? So we have to make sure that, you know, people are on their medications safely and make sure that we get a thorough history. So it's not just as easy as putting somebody on one medication and sending them on their way. We have to make individualized decisions for who might be a good fit for each medication.
Endocrinologist and Director of Obesity Medicine, Disha Narang, and nurse practitioner, Sarah Gossett here, fielding questions about diabetes care and management. You can bring your question or share a comment along the way. Call 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore advancements in diabetes care and new ways to treat a disease that touches the lives of hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites. Call in with a question about diabetes or share your experience, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Disha Narang is an endocrinologist and director of obesity medicine at Northwestern Medical Group in Illinois. And Sarah Gossett is a certified nurse practitioner at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. Sarah, there's been reports of widespread shortages of Ozempic and other weight loss drugs for diabetes patients. How are healthcare professionals responding to these shortages?
It's been a real challenge. These drugs are very popular for a reason, not only for the weight loss benefits, but they also have cardiovascular benefits as well. We've heard a lot about Ozempic in the media recently, but it's important to note that semaglutide, which is the actual drug, is sold under three different brand names. So Ozempic is FDA approved for type 2 diabetes, and that's the once weekly injectable. Rybelsus is the oral version taken daily, and Wegovy is the weekly version for weight loss. So Wegovy is FDA approved for weight loss, Ozempic for type 2 diabetes, it's the same thing. However, many insurance companies do not cover weight loss medications. So many providers, myself included, and I've dug my own grave here, in order to help those struggling with obesity, have prescribed Ozempic off-label to help with weight management. There was a major shortage of Wegovy for about a year and a half, and so people who had been doing well on that therapy in order to maintain were tried to switch to Ozempic, and so that exacerbated that shortage. But in addition, as Dr. Narang said, there are more people diagnosed with type 2 diabetes every day. And other than metformin, GLP-1 agonists are usually the next step in therapy if appropriate for the patient. So more people are diagnosed. This is more prescribed more often, and that exacerbates the shortages.
And when you say you go off-label, what does that mean?
It means that a drug is not specifically indicated for what you're using it for. Yeah, sorry, I didn't clarify
that. No, that's okay. That's okay. Dr. Narang, Ozempic has been prescribed to diabetes patients for at least 5 years. How effective is it?
It's been very effective, and we have different GLP-1 agonists as well. We have liraglutide, which is a daily injectable, dulaglutide, which is another weekly injectable, Ozempic, of course, which is semaglutide, as Sarah mentioned, and we have a new agent called tirzepatide, which is a combination of GIP and GLP-1. We have older GLP-1s as well, exenatide. So we have several agents right now that we have available for use in type 2 diabetes. Now, as we've sort of advanced in the last decade or so, they've become more and more effective in terms of blood sugar lowering and weight loss. And the new studies that are coming out are showing more and more significant weight loss, with medications such as tirzepatide. And so, these have been really, really game changing in the treatment of both diabetes and weight management. And oftentimes, both these conditions overlap in a patient. And so as someone with type 2 diabetes and obesity loses weight, their insulin sensitivity improves. So actually, that decreases the need for other medications such as insulin or other oral agents that people may be on. And so, overall, we've seen cardiovascular benefits, we've seen blood sugar benefits, and people have been able to bring their diabetes numbers into remission, with the combination of lifestyle and medication use. And so the medications alone are not magic wands, whether we use it for weight management or diabetes, but we really need to continue to emphasize that, a combination of a healthy lifestyle, which means, making sure that your dietary pattern is conducive towards improving your blood sugars, regular activity and exercise, and a combination of medications, that's where you get, the magic happening with good results.
As we talk about these medications, dieting companies, Weight Watchers, and Noom started offering customers prescriptions to Ozempic and other drugs to help with weight loss. And Sarah, what do you make of that change in practice?
I think that they're realizing that obesity is a very complex chronic illness. It's not simply about willpower and monitoring intake and exercise. There's genetics involved and environmental factors. And so the diet and exercise does not work for all people. And sometimes you need an additional tool in order to reach a healthier weight.
Sarah Gossett with a certified nurse practitioner at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, Dr. Disha Narang at Northwestern Medical Group, endocrinologist, as we talk about diabetes care. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your questions. Dr. Narang, being overweight raises the risk for type 2 diabetes, as we talked about, raises the risk for heart disease and stroke. How do you talk with patients about weight management and the risks of diabetes?
Yeah, this is something I see every day in my clinic. And so patients do specifically come to see me for weight management. But I think that, it's important to ask patients if they're ready to talk about it. Most of these patients have struggled with weight for most of their lives, or at least several years by the time they at least come in to see me. They know the journey, they know the struggle. All of these people at some point have been shamed, or judged for their weight. And so, it's something that people can relate to, at least in my patient population. But I think that they're here for a reason. They want to be able to get, to a point where they are avoiding some of these metabolic complications, such as heart disease, high cholesterol, hypertension, diabetes. And I think it's really important to start that conversation to say, it's not about the number on the scale. It is not about, the way you look or the fact that you're going to be 120 pounds again. But even 5%, 5 to 10% of weight loss can improve all of these other metabolic markers like your cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes numbers, cardiovascular risk. And so it's all about progress, not perfection. We don't need, Sports Illustrated models, coming out of my clinic. It's nothing like that. But we are very concerned about basically lowering someone's cardiovascular risk and, of course, adding years back to their lives. And the fact that someone can, may not have necessarily been able to walk down their driveway to pick up the mail, the fact that if they can lose a certain amount of weight and be comfortable walking again, that's a win in my book, right? And so I think we have to measure success in different ways, but I think not only quality of life, but part of it is really preventing these long-term illnesses. And I think people, when they're ready to do it, I think people are very invested in making that happen. Now, going back to all of this, the shortages of the medications have made it obviously very tough, as we mentioned earlier. But what we do have in our control right now is our environment. We have in control, the amount of processed food that we're bringing into our, day-to-day lives every day. We have in control how often, we go out to eat, how much activity we have. So I think that's something that, people are talk about medications a lot, but how are we curating our environment to
The
prevent
environment
and
around
improve?
us. Yes. Dr. Nisha Narang, endocrinologist and obesity medicine director, Sarah Gossett, certified nurse practitioner. You can join in on diabetes, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the State Health Department, diabetes is on the rise across Wisconsin and across the nation. We received comments from listeners who say we should examine the latest developments in diabetes care. You can call in with a question or comment now, 800-642-1234. We have Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse certified nurse practitioner Sarah Gossett here and Dr. Disha Narang, endocrinologist, obesity medicine, and culinary medicine specialist at Northwestern Medical Group. Sarah, looking at early diagnosis, how early can diabetes be detected and management of the disease started?
I'm really glad you brought this up, Kate, because one of the things that I see frequently is people who are diagnosed very late after symptoms are already showing and they may already have complications. As Dr. Narang said, people with diabetes often do not have any symptoms early in the disease process. So it's really important for people to have a yearly physical and have regular lab screening based on age, family history, and other comorbidities that they may have. And often that includes a fasting glucose, which will, if abnormal, you can start taking action right away, whether modifying diet, increasing exercise, or starting a medication. It's much easier to treat early diabetes diagnosis rather than much later in the game. If you're already having complications, you may require additional medications not related to the actual diabetes, maybe chronic kidney disease or neuropathy, which is nerve damage. And you also may require more than one medication right off the bat.
Dr. Narang, can you explain the A1C test and how that works in diabetes management?
Yes. So the A1C is a glycated hemoglobin, A1C. And so just sort of in layman's terms, it's the glucose molecule that's tied to your red blood cell. And your red blood cell renews every 120 days in your body. And so we typically, in patients with diabetes, diagnosed diabetes, we check the A1C every 3 months, so every 120 days on average. And what that shows us is what the diabetic or blood sugar control has been over that 3 month period. So what that reflects is an overall average blood sugar value. So I can tell, depending on what someone's A1C is, what their overall blood sugar average has looked like, in the last 3 months. So if we're looking at a goal of having an A1C less than 7%, that means that we want someone's overall blood sugar average to be less than about 150 or so. Now, if we're coming in with A1Cs of, 10%, 11%, that tells me that, average blood sugars have ranged, mid 200s or above for the last several months. And so it's a good measure to understand, where is someone ranging, and it also helps us guide therapy. Now, with the use of continuous glucose monitoring, that's actually allowed us to really visualize what these blood sugars look like day to day. So the A1C, to go back, is an average. So that's an average of all the high blood sugars. It's an average of all the low blood sugars. So the A1C may also look falsely good as well. So if, you know, so people are running in the 400s and 40s, well, then the average is going to look pretty good. So it's really important to use that A1C in correlation with people's blood sugar readings as well to really guide therapy.
I want to ask you as well, and when you talk about continuous glucose monitoring, these devices and the latest technology around diabetes management, are these devices accessible and affordable for patients, these new advancements?
Yeah, so I know Sarah mentioned this earlier, and I can't speak for Wisconsin, so I apologize, but in Illinois Medicaid does cover continuous glucose monitors for people who are at least on one injection of insulin. Medicare now covers continuous glucose monitoring for people who are on one injection of insulin or more. So this has actually gotten better in the last year or two, because before they required 3 to 4 injections of insulin per day. So the coverage, I think, is improving because this has become the standard of care at this point. It really stinks to have to stick your finger multiple times a day because, one, it hurts, but two, it's also inconvenient. And the other is that it doesn't give us the perfect ability to understand, well, what is this person's blood sugar trends? Because people could start off the day at a normal blood sugar, and then depending on, you know, whatever they might be eating or how they might be exercising throughout the day, they could start at a good blood sugar and end the day at a good blood sugar. Or they might start the day, you know, in a good range, but then end the day in 300s because, you know, they went out to eat and had some ice cream after dinner, and and people have no idea. So I think it's been really helpful for patients to see, you know, this is what my blood sugar does when I eat, you know, this kind of food. And this is how I can make changes to what I'm eating, because I saw that my blood sugar really spiked after I ate such and such food. And so I think it's been helpful from a behavioral standpoint. I think it's been helpful from being able to dose, you know, medications for both the patients and the providers. And then it's also helpful from the provider standpoint, because I can very much individualize someone's therapy based on what those sugar trends look like, but then also talk through, you know, how do we make this better? And then in, you know, in the digital age now, because of virtual health visits and telehealth visits, we can download people's, you know, CGM monitors or CGM downloads easily and be able to do a quick telehealth visit. And I have someone's data right in front of me, and we can still guide therapy. So, it's really, you know, go ahead.
You have much more visibility of the day-to-day and much better points of contact with the patient in terms of what their blood sugar is doing throughout the day. So yes. I definitely can see that. Sarah, do you find our smartphone tracking apps changing diabetes management, or have you seen any impacts from artificial intelligence becoming part of diabetes care?
I haven't seen artificial intelligence yet. In terms of the smartphone, you know, it does link to the continuous glucose monitor. So you can share data either with a loved one. You know, if someone is very prone to low blood sugars, there are alarms on these things. But if someone drops very quickly, whoever you're sharing your data with would also be alerted. I think this is especially helpful for parents who have children with type 1 diabetes and they can't always be around them. I know we're talking about type 2. It's just a side note. Mm-hmm. And there are also apps, too, that can help with food tracking and noting patterns if people are trying to monitor their intake. And you can link that with blood sugars as well.
Dr. Durang, there's also been discussions about smart insulin pens. What would be the difference there?
Yeah, so with those kinds of pens, they will often link to the continuous glucose monitor. And based on the sugar, you know, you can guide how much insulin you're able to give yourself. They also are able to calculate, you know, carb ratios and those kinds of things when you are having to dose insulin for particular meals. And so it's actually really helpful for patients who may not necessarily want an insulin pump, but may, you know, need to be counting carbs or need to be taking insulin multiple times a day. It helps to guide dosing instructions.
We're talking with Dr. Disha Narang at Northwestern Medical Group and Sarah Gossett, certified nurse practitioner at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. And you can call in with your questions about diabetes at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Narang, you know, as you talk about all of the ways to monitor the glucose and monitor blood sugar, how do you know whether to prescribe a rapid-acting insulin or very long-lasting insulin? What goes into those types of decisions?
Right. A lot of it is also comfort and experience, so I don't necessarily, you know, expect anybody to be able to do that quickly. But for rapid-acting insulin, if you're looking at a continuous glucose, you know, monitor, and if someone's blood sugar rises significantly after each meal, for example, and then either just stays high or doesn't really come back down to normal, that might be an indication to start some rapid-acting insulin with meals. Some patients, though, may be able to get away with one just long-acting insulin per day, and that might keep blood sugars level. But they may need to combine that with, you know, a few other oral medications, for example. So there's, again, this is going to be very, very individualized for each person. But the higher the A1C gets, especially above an A1C of 10%, the more likely someone might be to, you know, require mealtime insulin.
Sarah, what is the role of genetics in developing diabetes versus environmental factors that could also trigger the disease?
Yep. So there's a saying, genetics loads the gun and environment pulls the trigger. So family history is very important. If you come from a family where there's a strong history of diabetes, you are at greater risk of developing it too. But it's also how you are conducting your lifestyle. So if you know you have a risk of diabetes and you're focused on avoiding as much processed food as possible, getting regular physical activity, you can reduce that risk significantly. There are also a lot of things in the environment that we can't control. We're finding a lot of endocrine disruptors in the environment and learning more about them all the time. You know, triclosan was in antibacterial soap for a long time, and then we find out, oh, that's not good for us. We're finding more about PFAS. So there are things that we cannot control as well, and we're learning more about those all the time.
Sarah Gossett, taking your questions about all aspects of diabetes care and related effects of the disease, we have endocrinologist Disha Narang. Join in with what you wonder about diabetes or share a concern. Call 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We look into how to prevent and address diabetes. A special thanks to all the caller suggestions for this topic of conversation. Still time to bring up what you wonder about diabetes. Call in with the question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Gossett is a certified nurse practitioner in diabetes care and metabolism in La Crosse, and Dr. Disha Narang has an endocrinology practice in Lake Forest, Illinois. Let's bring in Steve in Mineral Point. Hi, Steve. What would you like to ask about?
Hi. I've got a daughter who, a granddaughter who just recently acquired type 2 diabetes at about age 11. And we were curious if there's any known links between that and the coronavirus. Thank you.
Yes, Steve, thank you. And Dr. Narang, I'm just going to repeat a little bit. Is there any link between the coronavirus and diabetes with a granddaughter who has become diabetic at age 11?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. I know that's a young diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. You know, the topic of the COVID-19 virus and its link to diabetes, it's being actively researched. And so in short, we don't really know yet. However, from a clinical experience, when we were in the height of the pandemic, at least in the adult world, there were several cases where COVID sort of unlocked diabetes. And so when people really came in sick to the hospital, you know, with COVID and all the respiratory, you know, consequences of that, people suddenly developed this new diagnosis of diabetes because, you know, an A1C would be checked when they came into the hospital and it would be elevated. I think there may have been some unmasking of potentially brewing diabetes in that population. I think there is some thought for type 1 diabetes that there may have been a virus, you know, in either the patient or even potentially family history that could have triggered, you know, the creation of antibodies that then caused, you know, the loss of beta cells and loss of insulin production, but that's also in type 1. So I think this is a very interesting question, and I think it's an important question just given sort of how much of an effect COVID has had on our world, but this is very much an active area of research, and I don't think we necessarily have all the answers behind it, unfortunately.
Sarah, how do you approach working with children who are diagnosed with diabetes versus an adult?
I it involves a lot of the parents because children are not in control of what they eat normally, and so it's a lot of education, whether type 1 or type 2. There's a lot of education that goes into what is the pathophysiology of diabetes and what kinds of foods affect blood sugars, how to detect hypoglycemia and how to help the child, how to do medication management, how to check blood sugars. There's a lot of education. Diabetic educators are fantastic. And we also do a lot of close follow-up after initial diagnosis to determine how people are coping emotionally as well, because it's a really big deal to be diagnosed with a chronic illness at a young age, and it can be extremely stressful for the entire family and the patient.
And there's so much more they also need to learn about their body and right. how to respond to it when their body does one thing and they think it should be doing something else. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I always stress to parents is that, no, you cannot cause type 1 diabetes. Sometimes I hear, unfortunately, well, she was just drinking too much soda or she was eating too much candy. And I say, well, no, you know, type 1 is, it's an autoimmune disorder. It happens. She did not cause this.
Mm. Let's bring in Karen in Galena. Karen, hi.
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 My question is, as far as endocrine disruptors, is there a reliable list? I mean, there's a lot of information on the internet. Like, is my shampoo really bad for me?
Karen, thank you for that. Dr. Narang, could you expand on that?
Yeah, you know, this is also a confusing topic. And, you know, obviously, yes, there will be some lists online, and they're not always reliable. So a official list, I actually don't think that there is one on there, and I'm happy to be corrected on that, but I personally have not seen a list of official, you know, endocrine disruptors. This is, again, a very active area of research, and it's been going on for several years. But, you know, I think the important thing is that we make sure, and, you know, it really comes down to like the processing nature of things, right? And it's not necessarily your shampoo or shampoo bottle that's going to cause these sorts of issues. I think, you know, what is in our control? And you know, I said this earlier in the hour, but what is in our control is what kind of food we're putting into our bodies each day, right? And so what I would do is that cutting back on some of the processed foods that we have is probably the best way to kind of decrease our risk for some of these things. And, you know, sure, various, you know, plastic agents and other endocrine disruptors and things, they're all around us, but that's not necessarily something that we can control. So what I would say is that what we can control is what I would take charge of. And quite frankly, I think the thing that's really sort of glaring in front of us is sort of, you know, how big the processed food industry is.
Mm. Karen, as a follow-up, is wondering how much of an effect does an alcoholic drink have on you before dinner? How does an alcoholic drink before dinner affect blood sugar?
Is that for really me or Sarah?
Oh, Sarah, go ahead. Sure.
I think it really depends on what type of alcoholic drink you are having. If you have something like a margarita that has a lot of added sugar to it, it will affect your blood sugars quite significantly. And alcohol can cause both high blood sugars and low blood sugars later on. So it is important to, you know, always consume alcohol in moderation. But there are lower carbohydrate alcoholic beverages. There is low carbohydrate beer. Wine is very low. So it's really what you're mixing it with.
Okay. Karen, thank you for the call. Dr. Nuring, as we discussed diet and nutrition, last year the Cleveland Clinic warned the keto diet can reduce blood sugar but may not be right for everyone. Do popular diet fads like keto or paleo or Atkins, is it helpful to the health of diabetes patients, or what do you see there?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked this question. So a diet, those fad diets are just that, they're fads. And the reason why they are fads is that they are very difficult to maintain consistency with long term. So if you decide that you're not going to eat carbs, you know, for the next 25 years of your life, and you think you can sustain that, you know, more power to you. But quite frankly, in my experience, I have found that those have been very, very tough to sustain after a few weeks. The other is that we need carbs to survive. And so what I think a lot of these bad diets have done has they've demonized carbs, that carbs are bad. And that's not necessarily true. You know, I think what is negative and can affect us in a negative way is the processed carbs. So, you know, all the carbs that we're getting from fast food, or all the carbs that are out of boxes or bags and things like that. But, you know, grains are really good for you. They're a very significant part of the Mediterranean diet. You know, so things like oats and whole grains and farro, barley, quinoa, brown rice, all those things are high fiber carbs that are actually really, really good for you. So saying that, oh, I'm just going to cut carbs out. Well, our body needs glucose to survive, but we need to just make sure that we're putting good quality glucose into our bodies. So what I would say is that if you're thinking about a diet, imagine to yourself, am I going to be doing this for the next 25 years of my life? And is this sustainable? And if the answer is no, then we got to move on from it.
In our few seconds left, Sarah, can you anticipate when something you see in a patient may not be sustainable in their diet?
Like Dr. Nuring said, if you're cutting out an entire food group, that's not sustainable. It's very hard to maintain. I sometimes will try fad diets so I can actually tell patients when they're talking about it, like, this is what I found. I mean, I don't do it for very long. But like Dr. Nuring said, you need carbs to survive, and they do need to be the quality carbs. Staying away from highly processed food, I try to tell patients, if you see a lot of things on the bag that you cannot pronounce, it's too highly processed. Mm.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Gossett, certified nurse practitioner in endocrinology at the Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. And Dr. Nuring, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Disha Nuring, endocrinologist and director of obesity medicine at Northwestern Medical Group in Lake Forest, Illinois. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.